morning, and welcome to the WINY Talk Show. It's time for you to be heard. The talk show welcomes everyone's calls once per hour. Dial 928-1350 and tell Northeastern Connecticut your story.
Good morning. Welcome to another edition of the WINY Talk Show. I'm Paul Kutu. It is Friday, October 25th, and we have with us some guests from Access Connecticut, an old friend, Karen Caffrey. Welcome back, Karen.
Thank you, Paul.
And two new friends, Holly Harlow and Carolyn Goodrich. And why don't you, Karen, explain your one of the problems that they're having in Access Connecticut is trying to get access to birth records. The state legislature and its wisdom has decided not to, in the past, grant access to adoptees' records. And we've talked in the last show about how traumatic that can be. And hopefully this time when the session opens up, they will be able to make some headway. And with that in mind, Karen, go ahead.
Sure. We have our fingers crossed. What Access Connecticut is, it's a grassroots group of people, which are adoptees, birth parents, adoptive professionals, and our friends. And actually what we're trying to do is reestablish a right that we already have. And I really want to emphasize that, because that's something that people just really don't get. Even professionals in the field sometimes don't. Until 1975 in Connecticut, adult adoptees, adults, not children, had the right to get a copy of their original birth certificate. And this is the birth certificate that's created for an adoptee when they're born, not the amended birth certificate that is created at the time of adoption. Every adoptee has two birth certificates. So our sole little narrow goal is we just want our right back, the one that we had until 75, and that's what we're focusing on, and we'll be going back to the legislature in February and trying to get that to happen.
This, I'm imagining that in 1975 it was a well-intended progressive move to try to protect people, but it really hasn't.
Well, it hasn't. And it was historically, this information was open, and true information about an adoptee's identity was available up until 1975. There was a whole secrecy thing. It was sort of the June and Ward Cleaver time in society when everyone was happy and everyone was smiling, and there's a lot of sort of, in society in general, a lot of pretense and unreality. And the thinking from that era, unfortunately, got codified in the 70s. It seems a little late, but that's what happened. And so it's like we're living in this sort of a nightmarish June and Ward Cleaver episode, and we're wanting to update things and bring us all into the present.
By not working, I meant sometimes there are many unintended consequences.
Unintended, without a doubt, yes.
And that seems to be the problem that I got from the last time you were on. They probably did it for the right reasons, but it turned out in many ways to be the wrong thing.
Right, there was a misperception that women who had relinquished a child, birth mothers, had really chosen this freely, and they really wanted to, they could and wanted to go and forget about it and everything would be fine. And the reality is that was very much not fine. And today, 95% of women who relinquish child want contact with and consent to contact with their adult adoptees. And frankly, as Holly, one of our other guests will talk about today, because Holly is a birth mother, they were very much not fine. The vast majority of these young women were pressured and coerced and forced to relinquish their children. And it's not something that they forgot or that they were happy about or that they wanted or needed protection from their grown children.
And just the pressure of society, the pressure of
religious forces, societal forces. There was just
economics.
Economics, but more, it was more cultural and religious and social pressure. The shame, the stigma, there was a thinking at the time, actually, that women who got pregnant out of wedlock, and that's mostly where these children came from, were actually mentally unbalanced.
Oh, goodness.
I'm giving you the history here, Paul. I'm speaking the truth. But that they were really defective in some way. And that they were that it was the right thing to do was to just send them off to a secret place and basically force them to sign papers and give their babies away.
Or I thought the one that when I was in high school that I remember that was a little more stark than that.
Mm-hmm.
You got pregnant, you had to quit school.
Oh, that was that. That's exactly that, right.
I can remember, dear. You know, you'll be leaving now. We watched it. It was like, oh my God.
These girls were a bad influence. And this was the time before birth control was available in our culture. It was, and so it's not like kids don't do things like have sex just because there isn't birth control. So yeah, it was an incredible stigma in a way that it's almost hard for us to imagine now.
We're the boomers. We're the virgin generation. Don't
you well, isn't that nice? hi Ward. There's Ward Cleaver showing up.
That's what we said anyway.
Yes, and it was a social experiment. It was really not just an adoption, but I think the whole fantasy and pretense approach was a social experiment based on shame.
If we didn't face it, it didn't happen.
Exactly. If we didn't face it, if we pretend it's not happening, it's not happening. That doesn't work so well.
Now, Carolyn, you're a social worker, and you've been doing this for many, many years. Tell us some of your experiences, what you found.
Well, I started working in adoption in the 1970s, and I still saw a lot of the secrecy. Some of the agencies, I've worked for a lot of different agencies over the years, and some were still not encouraging families to tell the children they were adopted, and some were definitely secretive about the parents. When I moved to Maine and worked for an agency up there, and we began asking the birth mothers to put pictures of themselves in the files for the child when they got older. And we encouraged them to be more participatory in the process. And eventually, now, most adoptions, particularly of infants, the birth parents are involved in selecting the adoptive family and often have continued contact. So up to 95% of adoptions now have some form of openness. So the secrecy is from the past. It's from those years prior to the 70s and 80s. And I don't think the laws have kept up with the changes in practice.
That would probably be the best selling point for legislators. They're always wanting to clean up antiquated language. And I think you just made an excellent point. This is really culturally antiquated language.
It's an antiquated practice.
Yeah. And practice, of course. Yeah. And the language then drives the practice. Holly, how has this affected you as a birth mother?
How has the pending legislation affected
you? Well, how's the current situation that birth mothers are in? And how did it affect you at the time?
At the time of my surrender, it was 1975. I wasn't required by my family to go away and be secret. But I faced that subtle, by 1975, maybe just a very subtle kind of, well, darling, my counselor would tell me, two-parent families are really the best way to raise your child. How do you expect your child to have all of its needs? My financial shortcomings were pointed out to me. And I had watched other women in society be treated like they shouldn't be here. They should go away. They should be silent. And I fought that in myself because I thought, well, I'm not that way. I don't want my child to be, I want to know who my child is. I want them to know who I am. I told my counselor that in my pre-birth sessions. So I proceeded with this attitude that I have not forgotten my child. I hope she wants to know me. And come the day where I'm able to change that, I will. So, and I've been working towards opening those records since about 1989 myself.
Wow, that's got to be a frustrating journey.
It is, and it's very frustrating when I feel almost responsible for having done that to my daughter. That the fact that I surrendered her now prevents her from having a right that other people have.
Yeah, there are people in the country that they do have the right and others do not. The liberalization of some of these laws is happening and probably more quickly than some people would want. But at the same time, in your situation, since 89, my God, that's got to be heart-wrenching in some ways.
It's difficult as a mother who surrendered a child. I've taken to call myself a mother who surrendered a child because I am. As a mother, it's really frustrating to hear other people talk about me as if they know what I want.
Ah, yeah.
And
I get it.
And again, like you mentioned before, Paul, the intention perhaps is well-intended, or the objective is well-intended, but it's frustrating for people to talk for me. I know I have sisters in motherhood out there who still might be very traumatized to what happened to them. And I accept that. I sympathize with them. I would love to be able to bring them comfort to the level that I'm at. But that isn't carved in stone for any mother out there who's even aware that this is happening and is afraid.
Because you're very alone at a time like that.
Yes, absolutely.
And there's nobody can do it for you.
Nope.
You've got to make the decision. And I, as a former teacher, I have high school kids. I used to talk to my students about this. One of the, and the choices are grim. I had a class of seniors where one, we had a, someone had had an abortion, and someone had given up a child to adoption. And the subject came up, and you want to see a battle royal going on. And I just, you know, it was under control, but I let it happen. It was probably the best education those kids could have gotten as to what you face. My summary at the end was, as you see, there's no easy out to this. There is a price to pay no matter what you choose. That was, you know, and then they were a little frustrated with each other, but eventually they were hugging each other again. These are emotional issues, and they're issues that sometimes we get into emotional issues in this society, and we kind of push the emotion to the side because we really don't want to face it because there are no easy answers.
Well, and then also there is this juncture where emotion and personal feeling and personal experience comes to what should be legislated and what should not. I don't know of any other situation in society where an uncomfortable reaction is legislated against, you know, where an embarrassment or something that's hurt you deeply, where you're protected by law to never having to experience anything else, even if it infringes on someone else's right.
I growing up at the time that I did, girls got pregnant. And they certainly were treated as damaged goods emotionally, and they don't. And I think you said it well. Mm-hmm. You can't let those bad girls be around our good girls, which was absolutely ridiculous and barbaric. The good girls were probably having sex too, but they just didn't get pregnant. That's how hypocritical it all was.
And we
knew it too.
For me, even as someone who was surrendering my daughter and knowing that I wanted her to know me someday, I was still afraid of judgment from other people. You know, if I, when I was pregnant, if I ran into somebody I knew, it was pretty anxious for me because the personal feeling I felt towards my child was, I don't want to be anonymous to you, but I'm kind of afraid of other people's judgment of me, you know, and that's just something that when you live with this experience, your feeling about what you want, what you need, what you deserve changes, evolves. Maybe it's some maturity where you eventually, it didn't matter to me what other people thought. My fear of judgment went away. And here I am. Here I sit in a radio station talking about it.
Well, you know, there's probably a catharsis for you, mm-hmm. and there's information that you're giving to others, and in your teaching, mm-hmm. and that's a good thing. And we're back. Access Agency of Connecticut, which is basically working right now to change some of the laws on birth records for adoptees. We have Karen Caffrey, Holly Hollow, and Carolyn Goodrich who are here, and Karen's been here before and is an excellent spokesman for her group.
Thank you.
You have a movie coming out. That just kind of an informational movie to kind of help people understand the issue a little bit.
Yes, there's a woman named Ann Fessler. She first wrote a book called The Girls Who Went Away, and it's she interviewed and recorded the stories of many women, mostly from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, who released their children for adoption. And then she created a film. It's called A Girl Like Her. And it's an amazingly powerful documentary. Access Connecticut is sponsoring a screening of it at Real Art Ways on Saturday, November 9th at 1 o'clock. It's free. We would like to invite everybody listening to come. And we think it's so important because, as you're getting the sense listening to Holly telling her story, there is so much myth and misinformation about these women, and this film really speaks the truth, and we want that truth. We support reality. So
reality
a good basis for psychological well-being.
Truly, you know, I can remember in the 60s when I was in high school, if you rang the bell, you had to get married. I knew some people that happened to, and some of them, their marriages made it. A lot of them didn't. Mm. Because it really was, you get married for different reasons than you have sex sometimes. Mm. I guess put plain English.
Yep, exactly.
I think the idea that it never happened, or was it only happened if you got pregnant, and then it happened.
Right.
It was an act of the ultimate hypocrisy.
Yes.
Because, you know, it just like my kid doesn't drink, but he goes to drinking parties, okay?
But just, he sits in the corner and sips of water.
Just 7-Up for me. Yeah, okay, yeah, that right. Doesn't happen too often either, but it's never your kid. It's somebody else's.
Yeah, you know, you made a point earlier, Paul, about antiquated laws, and that's really what's going on here. We're trying to bring the laws to match the current day reality, and there are two states that never closed access. There are six states, including Maine, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island, who have enacted access. Rhode Island is recently as 2011.
Right.
And we were just talking on the break. Pennsylvania, which we're very excited about, has passed this legislation unanimously out of committee and by their House just 2 days ago. So we're very excited. We're hoping Pennsylvania, they might beat us to the punch here. We really hope so.
Well, they're a major state, and the fact you got through the House, which is, you know, really the people's
legislative
voice. Group, mm-hmm. That's their voice. So, and I would imagine that will probably get through, given the fact there's not really a lot of pushback on the other side.
No, the pushback's because people don't understand the situation.
Do people misunderstand your goals as a group? Is there a misunderstanding of what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I think there is. And actually, the big misunderstanding comes, most people don't understand the actual birth certificate situation for adopted persons. Every adoptee has two birth certificates. There is a true birth certificate that's created when a child is born. This is true in every state, which has the name of the actual biological mother, the biological father, if known, and the child. Then, if this child is relinquished for adoption, later on, after the adoption, the adoptive parents had this child, there's an amended birth certificate created up to a year later. What it does is it substitutes the adoptive parents' names for the biological parents. It's backdated to the date of birth, so that if you look at an adoptee,
so it's a lie.
It's a lie. Okay. It's a false document. If, like, my legal birth certificate says my adoptive mother gave birth to me, and it was backdated to my date of birth, and so when I go to get married and I have to show a birth certificate, I'm going to join the army. I show my birth certificate. That's what I show. The original birth certificate, the true birth certificate, is sealed. And that's what we want to change the law. This is the only change we're trying to get done, so that an adult, not a child, an adult adoptee can get a copy of that original birth certificate.
Let's take a phone call. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm listening to you in the car, and I'm beyond radio range, so I'm glad they put me on hold so I could follow along. I'm coming at this from the perspective of a two-time adoptive brother and a two-time adoptive parent. And I think the issue that's really needed to be addressed on the perspective of the adoptees is access to medical history from the birth family, the grandparents on both sides, and the birth parents. When at the point of adoption, yes, there is some medical info available, but, you know, if you have a kid now who's 25 years old, what's taken place in the 25 years since? You don't have any idea, you know, what's going on, and that's really what needs to be opened up much more, I believe, than just finding out who you are.
I think you're absolutely right.
There's got to be a way that the state legislature, I don't think you can go back, but I think that the state has got to compel that there's got to be a repository somehow that somebody can go in with a code number or whatever and say that, you know, if the child was born in 1990 and in the year 2010, you know, that grandfather had a heart attack, had heart disease, or grandmother died of cancer or something like that, or Parkinson's, MS, you know, or HIV popped up somehow in a second generation down the road in the birth parent or something like that. There's got to be a way that it's just not fair. That's really what's not fair to the adoptees.
Well, good point. I think that we discussed this a little bit in the first show that they were on. I mean, if you're an African American couple and sickle cell anemia runs in your family, or a Jewish couple with Tay-Sachs,
you got it.
I mean, you want to know the genetic strain here, and you know how it could affect you. Sure.
Yeah, the caller makes an excellent point. And our bill does provide for a medical history form that can be filed with the original birth certificate. So because that is absolutely critical. All the medical history that an adoptee can obtain in Connecticut is dated from the date of adoption. In my case, that history is now 53 years old. And since that time, because I did find my birth family, I've discovered a history of breast cancer in my biological family, a history of colon cancer. This is critical, and it's part of our bill.
Yeah, well, there it is. I mean, this says it all.
So in other words, a part of your bill is something going forward.
Yes.
Meaning what's taken place since the date of adoption in the birth family.
Yes. What our bill provides for is that a birth parent can file with the state an updated medical history form that contains all that information, because we agree right. That's absolutely critical.
Right. You just said the birth parent can file. What about requiring? I don't want to throw any water on to discourage adoption, but what about making it mandatory, because there's a kid out here who doesn't have the information and needs to get it? It's only fair.
Well, I agree with you that it's absolutely essential. I'm not sure we're at a point where the legislature would be willing to make that mandatory, but I think everybody recognizes the need, and what's missing is a system, and what we're proposing is at least a mechanism for that to happen.
Well, it's a good start, maybe.
All right. Well, call your legislators. Let's get them on board. All right. Thank you. Thank you for the call. Bye. Good call.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. You said it all. When you start to find out there's a history of certain things in your family, you can't do proactive if you don't know anything.
Exactly. And it can affect the treatment, the medical treatment that you get from a doctor if you do develop a condition. It can help you take preventative steps if you know you have this kind of some kind of medical history that puts you at risk.
Oh, boy. Okay. Holly, go ahead.
Hard to talk with those.
You practice. It gets easy after a while.
I think this is probably a given, but, you know, at the time of birth, I was 19 when my daughter was born, and my parents were barely 50. There were no health issues that were known in my family at that time. And going forward, there's plenty for someone to know about the health history in my family. And my daughter's actually benefited from knowing that, because she's my apple. She fell from my tree, and it's applicable to her. As far as going forward, everybody should absolutely have access to their medical history. I don't know that the mechanism is in place to be able to provide that through legislation or through any other kind of social networking. And people who have access to their family's identity can certainly go about that route in their own way.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. 928-1350, 1-800-246-WINY. That call there, if you'd like to call back, we'd be happy to take your call. But Carolyn, you had a point to make just before we broke.
Yes, so just to answer something of what you asked, the contact preference form that's included in our bill allows the birth parent to decide if they want contact or not, and that would be attached to the original birth certificate. So if the parent doesn't want contact, then they fill out the medical history form. But all those parents who don't mind having contact, the adoptee could get the information directly from the birth parent. Yeah.
So that can happen.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's at least a semi-positive, I guess,
yeah.
And because we're not trying to cloud the issue at all here. It's got to be difficult. I understand trying to change any law that's in place is always difficult. I think of a law that in Congress has been done away with. They just hang on and hang on, and even if they don't make any sense anymore, sometimes they hang on. In my own town charter, we're trying to get rid of antiquated language. And you know, sometimes people even vote against that because they think it's trick.
Oh, gosh.
Okay, I think I got that call back. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Great show. I've got a small series of questions that kind of dovetails into the last caller, and I'll just ask them and then take my answer off air. With regard to the whole health situation, I would think that the dads would have something, you know, there's half of the health history missing there, number one. And secondly, are there any records available to fathers that may be thinking, gee, you know, I fathered a child some 20 years ago and that child's out there. Is there any interest or activity on the paternal end is my question.
Good question.
Either birth parent could send in a medical history form, and they can contact the agency the place where their child was placed, so they can update information. But I think when and if this bill passes, we're going to have a lot of publicity and media coverage to get to the birth parents, both parents, so that they can either file a medical history form or the contact preference form.
The law originally was very, very biased against the female in that case. It was the female's fault that she got pregnant. She should have said no. The guy headed for the hills, in many cases, or a marriage took place. There is a void there, though. And what happens, it goes on. As a social worker, I'm sure you saw this a lot.
Yeah, there are actually a lot of birth certificates who have no father's names on them.
Right.
And it wasn't required for many years. The paternity bills were passed later into the 80s, and that's when father's rights came to the front, and they had to seek the father in each child.
And responsibilities also came along at that time. You have to be more responsible for the outcomes.
Right. So in many cases, it would have to be the birth father who takes the initiative to come forward, because if nobody has his name, nobody has any way of contacting him.
That's a cultural fight at that point in time as well.
Mm. Yeah, there's a real, in my opinion, a real misunderstanding of the nature of personal responsibility. The female, the woman, was held responsible for sexual behavior and for the behavior of the male, and the male got off scot-free. Let me amend that. Not emotionally,
yeah,
scot-free.
Let's amend that.
I meant it from society's perspective. For example, we were talking before about how girls who were pregnant were kicked out of school.
Right.
The boys who got them pregnant got to stay. So it certainly was not a neutral experience for birth fathers at all.
Not at all. Yeah. That's very true. And I think you bring up a good point about the emotional part of it. Mm. And neither party, in a case like that, is ever going to get off emotionally scot-free, no matter what happens, because it's a life changer.
Of course it is. Yeah.
And for all concern, and it's something you'll probably never forget, and you'll always wonder about.
And that was one of the misunderstandings that we're trying to correct, is that, you know, oh, and that was the pretense at the time. Oh, you'll just go on, young woman, and you'll forget about this. You'll have other children. It's like it's never happened. Which, as we sit here today, it's insane.
Well, we know better than that. If you lose a child, you can't replicate them by having more children.
Exactly.
That's just silliness, and we. I don't know. You kind of wonder sometimes how you got to where you were, and hopefully you can dig out of it and get to where you need to be. And I guess this times change.
Yeah, and I'd like to follow up on a point you made, Paul, in terms of antiquated laws. You know, what we're finding, legislators actually, if you go and talk to them, some of them actually respond. I want to put a shout out to our legislators, and that if there are people who are interested, who are listening, who are interested in this, not just call your legislators, you can contact us. A lot of what we're doing now is organizing people, helping our own volunteers to have correct information, teaching them how to call and make contact with their legislators. Our website is www.accessconnecticut.org. Just like it sounds, all one word, accessconnecticut.org. We have a Facebook page that is very active, and we're on Twitter.
And can it be accessct.org, or does that have to be the full name, Connecticut?
The full name. Spell it out, accessconnecticut.org. And we have an email newsletter, so we're really trying to help people learn how to affect the political process. That's a real big thing for a lot of people. We don't know, you know, how do we go about doing it? Who would we call? What do we say?
You're doing good work. I hope the legislature, in its wisdom, will bring this to the governor. I can't imagine if the legislature gets behind this that he would void this. Connecticut tends to be one of the more progressive states, and this is certainly progressive legislation that brings us up to speed with current practice, you know, culturally as well as taking care of a real void in the law. I mean, wait a minute. You're actually going to make a law that says we're going to lie? Essentially,
yes.
What they've done. No, we're going to lie. We're going to lie for everybody's good, but we're going to lie. Now, if they get caught lying as part of their professional duties, they can get impeached. But,
right. We're going to lie and we're going to keep it a secret. I mean, it's so antithetical to what we understand to be good law practice, good emotional practice, good mental health practice.
If you go back far enough, the birth certificate was amended during the years when any child who was born out of wedlock had illegitimate stamped in red across the birth certificate. And the state legislature wanted to protect the child from having to show that birth certificate to everybody through their life, so they created this amended birth certificate. But that,
did they ever think of this throwing the stamp away?
Yeah. Which you know? They did. Exactly. They did throw the stamp away, but in the meantime, they created this law to create amended birth certificates. But what I found in the years when I started placing older children for adoption and when we started placing with the non-traditional families, when you place a child in a single father's home, that child has a birth certificate that has no mother on it. And that's the birth certificate they have to present for the rest of their life.
My goodness gracious.
And that just made the lie so blatant to me.
Yeah, truly.
I have a story about that I'm not sure exactly what it adds to the conversation, but it does. There's a professional, I think she's a psychologist, works in the Boston area, who told this story at a conference that I was at, where she had a family, two children and a mom and dad. Mom passed away. Dad remarried. The new mom adopted the children, and an amended birth certificate was created naming her as the mother, and the father was distraught. Not only had his children lost their mother physically, but now they've lost any mention that she even existed to them, which is just a very powerful example of
it's
damage of an amended birth certificate.
Unintended consequence
exactly.
of bad
right.
law. And we're almost out of time. I want to thank you folks for coming in. Holly, I know you had it's got to be tough to do what you did, but you do it so well. You really do.
It's what I do.
You got a great radio voice. I told you that off air, but it's fantastic. Carolyn, many, many years being a social worker, understanding the problem. Good job.
Thank you.
And best of luck. And, you know, this is the second time you've been on with us, Karen, and you keep doing the good work, and I think you're going to be a good representative for your organization, and hopefully the legislators will listen.
Thanks, Paul, very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.